This is the Poetry Foundation's Essential American Poets podcast. Essential American Poets is an online audio poetry collection. The poets in the collection were selected in 2006 by Donald Hall when he was poet laureate. Recordings of the poets he selected are available online at poetryfoundation.org and poetryarchive.org. In this edition of the podcast, we'll hear poems by John Ashbery. Born in Rochester, New York in 1927, John Ashbery grew up on a farm near Lake Ontario. As a teenager, he took art classes and hoped to become a painter. Instead, Ashbery developed into one of the great American poets of the 20th century, although his ties with the art world stayed strong. He wrote art criticism for decades, and many critics believe his verse took shape under the influence of abstract expressionism. Ashbery is often associated with the so-called New York School of Poets, a group that included Frank O'Hara and Kenneth Koch, and was active during the 50s and 60s. Though he lived in France much of that time, Ashbery was a considerable influence on his contemporaries, both through his correspondence with O'Hara and his translations of French surrealists like Pierre Reverdy. Ashbery's first book, Some Trees, won the 1956 Yale Younger Poets Award. The contest judge, W.H. Auden, famously admitted later that he hadn't understood a word of the winning manuscript. Ashbery published many of his most famous books during the 1960s and 70s, including The Tennis Court Oath and what many consider his masterpiece, Self-Portrait in a Convex Mirror. This book won the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, and the National Book Critics Circle Award, an unprecedented achievement in the literary world. The author of over 20 volumes of poetry and translations, Ashbery's poetic voice often seems to contain many voices. His poems reference both pop culture and high literature and have spawned countless imitations by admiring younger writers. Many readers find the stream of perceptions in his poetry difficult to interpret. Ashbery once explained to the Times of London that his poetry is open-ended and various because life itself is. His poetry refuses to impose an arbitrary order on a world of flux and chaos. Ashbery's most recent books include A Worldly Country and Planisphere. He's also published a novel, A Nest of Ninnies, co-written with poet James Schuyler, and Reported Sightings, a selection from 3 decades of his art criticism. Over the course of his long career, John Ashbery has won nearly every award in American poetry, including a MacArthur Genius Grant. He was the Poet Laureate of New York State from 2001 to 2003 and taught at Bard College for several decades until his retirement in 2008. He lives in New York City and upstate with his partner, David Kermani. The following 7 poems were recorded in New York City in 2008.
I'm going to read Hotel L'Outre-Amont, which alludes to the mysterious 19th century French poet Isidore Ducasse, who called himself the Count de L'Outre-Amont. He lived in Paris in a series of small hotels around the Bourse section. And I think I was sort of thinking of him in these little hotels, which might have been 4 stories high, and then also of the little boxes behind the desk where the keys are kept when you go in. And it came out in 4 sections. Of 4 four-line stanzas. Hotel L'Outre-Amont. 1. Research has shown that ballads were produced by all of society, working as a team. They didn't just happen. There was no guesswork. The people then knew what they wanted and how to get it. We see the results in works as diverse as Windsor Forest and The Wife of Usher's Well. Working as a team, they didn't just happen. There was no guesswork. The horns of Elfland swing past, and in a few seconds we see the results in works as diverse as Windsor Forest and The Wife of Usher's Well, or on a more modern note, in the finale of the Sibelius Violin Concerto. The horns of Elfland swing past, and in a few seconds the world as we know it sinks into dementia, proving narrative passé, or in the finale of the Sibelius Violin Concerto. Not to worry, many hands are making work light again. The world, as we know it, sinks into dementia, proving narrative passé. In any case, the ruling was long overdue. Not to worry, many hands are making work light again, so we stay indoors. The quest was only another adventure. 2. In any case, the ruling was long overdue. The people are beside themselves with rapture, so we stay indoors. The quest was only another adventure, and the solution problematic, at any rate, far off in the future. The people are beside themselves with rapture, yet no one thinks to question the source of so much collective euphoria. And the solution? Problematic, at any rate, far off in the future. The saxophone wails, the martini glass is drained. Yet no one thinks to question the source of so much collective euphoria. In troubled times, one looked to the shaman or priest for comfort and counsel. The saxophone wails, the martini glass is drained, and night, like black swan's down, settles on the city. In troubled times, one looked to the shaman or priest for comfort and counsel. Now only the willing are fated to receive death as a reward, and night, like black swan's down, settles on the city. If we tried to leave, would being naked help us? 3. Now only the willing are fated to receive death as a reward. Children twist hula hoops, imagining a door to the outside. If we tried to leave, would being naked help us? And what of older, lighter concerns? What of the river? Children twist hula hoops, imagining a door to the outside, when all we think of is how much we can carry with us. And what of older, lighter concerns? What of the river? All the behemoths have filed through the maze of time, when all we think of is how much we can carry with us. Small wonder that those at home sit nervous by the unlit grate. All the behemoths have filed through the maze of time. It remains for us to come to terms with our commonality. Small wonder that those at home sit nervous by the unlit grate. It was their choice, after all, that spurred us to feats of the imagination. It remains for us to come to terms with our commonality, and in so doing deprive time of further hostages. 4. It was their choice, after all, that spurred us to feats of the imagination. Now, silently as one mounts a stair, we emerge into the open, and in so doing deprive time of further hostages to end the standoff that history long ago began. Now, silently as one mounts a stair, we emerge into the open, but it is shrouded, veiled. We must have made some ghastly error. To end the standoff that history long ago began, must we thrust ever onward into perversity? But it is shrouded, veiled. We must have made some ghastly error. You mop your forehead with a rose, recommending its thorns. Must we thrust ever onward into perversity? Only night knows for sure. The secret is safe with her. You mop your forehead with a rose, recommending its thorns. Research has shown that ballads were produced by all of society. Only night knows for sure. The secret is safe with her. The people then knew what they wanted and how to get it. I think this has been mentioned in reviews of this book as being about death, the anticipated stranger, which is more than likely. Anticipated stranger, the bruise will stop by later. For now, pain pauses in its round, notes the time of day, the patient's temperature, leaves a memo for the surrogate. What the hell did you think you were doing? I mean, oh well, less said the better, they all say. I'll post this at the desk. God will find the pattern and break it. This is sort of an unusual poem because it rhymes. I often write in a certain way just because I haven't done it before or because I haven't done it in a long time. Since I hate repeating myself, though of course one always has to repeat oneself since one remains the same person, usually. A worldly country. Not the smoothness, not the insane clocks on the square, the scent of manure in the municipal parterre, not the fabrics, the sullen mockery of Tweety Bird, not the fresh troops that needed freshening up. If it occurred in real time, it was okay, and if it was time in a novel, that was okay, too. From palace and hovel, the great parade flooded avenue and byway, and turnip fields became just another highway. Leftover bonbons were thrown to the chickens and geese who squawked like the very dickens. There was no peace in the bathroom, none in the china closet, or the banks where no one came to make a deposit. In short, all hell broke loose that wide afternoon. By evening, all was calm again. A crescent moon hung in the sky like a parrot on its perch. Departing guests smiled and called, "See you in church." For night, as usual, knew what it was doing, providing sleep to offset the great ungluing that tomorrow again would surely bring. As I gazed at the quiet rubble, one thing puzzled me. What had happened, and why? One minute, we were up to our necks in rebelliousness, and the next, peace had subdued the ranks of hellishness. So often it happens that the time we turn around in soon becomes the shoal our pathetic skiff will run aground in. And just as waves are anchored to the bottom of the sea, we must reach the shallows before God cuts us free. I was told recently at the Bowery Poetry Club where I read it, they always like to end with a Liszt poem because they apparently go over very well with audiences. I don't know why. Sleepers awake. Cervantes was asleep when he wrote Don Quixote. Joyce slept during the Wandering Rocks section of Ulysses. Homer nodded and occasionally slept during the greater part of the Iliad. He was awake, however, when he wrote the Odyssey. Proust snored his way through The Captive, as if legions of his readers after him. Melville was asleep at the wheel for much of Moby Dick. Fitzgerald slept through Tender is the Night, which is perhaps not so surprising. But the fact that Mann slumbered on the very slopes of the Magic Mountain is quite extraordinary, that he wrote it even more so. Kafka, of course, never slept, even while not writing or on bank holidays. No one knows too much about George Eliot's writing habits. My guess is she would sleep a few minutes, wake up and write something, then pop back to sleep again. Lew Wallace's 40 winks came, incredibly, during the chariot race in Ben-Hur. Emily Dickinson slept on her cold, narrow bed in Amherst. When she awoke, there would be a new poem, inscribed by Jack Frost on the windowpane. Outside, glass foliage chimed. Good old Walt snored as he wrote, and like so many of us, insisted he didn't. Moam snored on the Riviera. Agatha Christie slept daintily as a woman sleeps, which is why her novels are like tea sandwiches, artistic for the most part. I sleep when I cannot avoid it. My writing and sleeping are constantly improving. I have other things to say, but shall not detain you much. Never go out in a boat with an author. They cannot tell when they are over water. Birds make poor role models. A philosopher should be shown the door, but don't under any circumstances try it. Slaves make good servants. Brushing the teeth may not always improve the appearance. Store clean rags in old pillowcases. Feed a dog only when he barks. Flush tea leaves down the toilet, coffee grounds down the sink. Beware of anonymous letters. You may have written them in a wordless implosion of sleep. I wrote this poem in response to the death of a very dear friend. But like so many of my poems. I didn't set out to do that. I only realized after I'd written it that that was the subject of it, though someone who knew me might have been able to point it out even before I realized it. This room. The room I entered was a dream of this room. Surely all those feet on the sofa were mine. The oval portrait of a dog was me at an early age. Something shimmers, something is hushed up. We had macaroni for lunch every day except Sunday, when a small quail was induced to be served to us. Why do I tell you these things? You're not even here. After I finished writing it, it occurred to me that it was perhaps influenced by the novels of the Swiss writer Robert Walser, who is a favorite writer of mine and who writes a great deal about walking in the country and in the city. It also, I think, was partially suggested by some of the tales by Gerard de Nerval. There's a myth of him that he used to walk around Paris with a lobster on a leash. And when asked why he did so, he said, because it can't sing and it knows the secrets of the deep. This was told to me by the poet Frank O'Hara. I'm not sure if it's actually true. If you said you would come with me. In town, it was very urban, but in the country, cows were covering the hills. The clouds were near and very moist. I was walking along the pavement with Anna, enjoying the scattered scenery. Suddenly, a sound like a deep bell came from behind us. We both turned to look. It's the words you spoke in the past coming back to haunt you, Anna explained. They always do, you know. Indeed, I did. Many times this deep, bell-like tone had intruded itself on my thoughts, scrambling them at first, then rearranging them in apple pie order. Two crows, the voice seemed to say, were sitting on a sundial in the God-given sunlight, then one flew away. Yes, and then, I wanted to ask, but I kept silent. We turned into a courtyard and walked up several flights of stairs to the roof, where a party was in progress. This is my friend Hans, Anna said by way of introduction. No one paid much attention, and several guests moved away to the balustrade to admire the view of orchards and vineyards approaching their autumn glory. One of the women, however, came to greet us in a friendly manner. I was wondering if this was a harvest home, a phrase I had often heard but never understood. Welcome to my home. Well, to our home, the woman said gaily. As you can see, the grapes are being harvested. It seemed she could read my mind. They say this year's vintage will be a mediocre one, but the sight is lovely nonetheless. Don't you agree, Mr. Hans, I replied curtly. The prospect was indeed a lovely one, but I wanted to leave. Making some excuse, I guided Anna by the elbow toward the stairs, and we left. That wasn't polite of you, she said dryly. Honey, I've had enough of people who can read your mind. When I want it done, I'll go to a mind reader. I happen to be one, and I can tell you what you're thinking is false. Listen to what the big bell says. We are all strangers on our own turf in our own time. You should have paid attention. Now adjustments will have to be made. This poem is called How to Continue. It was written after I took a trip to Ireland where I stayed with some old friends. And we went to this little shop where there was an old lady who asked us where we were from. And I said, well, I'm from New York. And she, with perfect Irish accent, said, oh, that's nice. I'm from Boston. I was rather amused by that. So after the trip, having enjoyed seeing these friends so much, I wrote this poem, which is sort of about friendship and love. How to continue. Well, there once was a woman, and she kept a shop, selling trinkets to tourists not far from a dock, who came to see what life could be far back on the island. And it was always a party there, always different but very nice. New friends to give you advice, or fall in love with you, which is nice. And each grew so perfectly from the other, it was a marvel of poetry and irony. And in this unsafe quarter, much was scary and dirty, but no one seemed to mind very much. The parties went on from house to house. There were friends and lovers galore all around the store. There was moonshine in winter and starshine in summer, and everybody was happy to have discovered what they discovered. And then one day the ship sailed away. There were no more dreamers, just sleepers, in heavy attitudes on the dock, moving as if they knew how, among the trinkets and the souvenirs, the random shops of modern furniture. And a gale came and said, "It is time to take all of you away, from the tops of the trees to the little houses, on little paths so startled." And when it became time to go, they none of them would leave without the other, for they said, "We are all one here, and if one of us goes, the other will not go." And the wind whispered it to the stars. The people all got up to go and looked back on love.
That was John Ashbery, recorded in New York City in 2008 and used by permission of the author and Georges Borchardt Incorporated. You've been listening to the Essential American Poets podcast, produced by the Poetry Foundation in collaboration with poetryarchive.org. To learn more about John Ashbery and other Essential American Poets, and to hear more poetry, go to poetryfoundation.org.